The time is 11:02. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. Thank you, KBOO members, for your great support of KBOO Community Radio. If you're not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking where it says Donate Today. And when you do that, you'll be happy that you're supporting the food show, which is coming up next. Topics today include urban farming, food banks in Washington Gorge, blackberries, and a few other things. And we're happy that you're listening today. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Hopworks Urban Brewery, committed to creating world-class food and organic beer as sustainably as possible at their carbon-neutral eco-brew pubs. Hopworks is located at Southeast 29th and Powell Boulevard, and Hopworks Bike Bar is at North Williams and Shaver. Available on draft and in bottles throughout Cascadia. Information at 503-232-HOPS or hopworksbeer.com. Also by the Garden Spout, specializing in indoor garden gardening equipment, including horticultural lighting, environmental control, hydroponic and organic nutrients, and pest control. The Garden Spout is located at 4532 Southeast 63rd, just south of Foster in Portland. Information at 503-788-GROW. And here comes the food show.
Need some food in my belly. Need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food.
Welcome to the Food Show. I'm your host, Rachel Bennett. Today we have an interview with Pat Sajak from Washington Gorge Action Programs about their food bank programs. We also have an old French story from professional storyteller Brian Moore about a woman and her apple tree. At the end of the hour, we'll have a conversation with Heather Langhorst-Kell about measure yes on 92, a measure for not labeling GMOs in Oregon. We begin with an interview with Stacy Givens. Urban farming is trending upwards, but to actually be a successful urban farm is incredibly difficult. It takes insane amounts of hard work and an ability to network with a web of people involved in food. Stacy Givens, creator and owner of the Side Yard Farm and Kitchen, is definitely putting in the hard work, and her urban farm is thriving. She recently received a Local Hero Award from EcoTrust for her work. She spoke with Chris here in the KBOO studios about the process of creating the Side Yard and how it has evolved over the years. Here's that interview.
My name is Stacy Givens, and I am the owner of the Side Yard Farm and Kitchen.
So how did you establish Side Yard Farm?
Oh, Side Yard Farm. Well, I have to say my background is in the culinary arts. I've always worked in restaurants from the age of 15. Never stepped foot out of a kitchen, honestly. And I moved to Portland about 10 years ago. And I was just working in kitchens and, you know, you move on. Once you're done with the place, you learn everything you can, you move on to the next restaurant. And I found myself at a restaurant called Rocket, which is right off Burnside. It's now called Noble Rot. But it existed for 2 years. It was high-tech American cuisine, and the rad thing about it was the rooftop garden. So I hopped on board, and I worked in the kitchen, but I was really interested on what was going on upstairs. So I asked the chef, Leather Stores, hey, man, could I split my time within the kitchen and the rooftop? And he's like, sure, why not? You'll be our garden liaison, you know? And I was like, all right, cool. So I met...
And how much experience did you have to... You just jumped into the garden
with no experience. Just, you know, growing up, my mom, you know, we have a huge backyard and, you know, apple trees galore and a small patch for tomatoes and peppers, period. I would just watch her do it. Never did any gardening. So I met with the master gardener, Mark Boucher Cobert, who is an amazing mentor and friend of mine. And he basically showed me the ropes of small container gardening. We started with kiddie pools. There was about 50 kiddie pools, which didn't last very long in the high heat. They started to crack, and then we switched out to wooden beds. But that's where I learned about intensive farming and small container farming. I got really into it. And after the 2 years was up and they went under, I decided to start my own urban farm. So basically, I just started, I heard about the Coley neighborhood. Coley neighborhood is known for small little houses but huge plots of land. So I found myself walking around the Coley a lot. And this was right around the dead of winter, 2009, January. And I'm walking around and I see this empty plot of land. Mark Boucher-Cobert told me about it. His friends own the land. So I met with them, Bob and Julie Granger, wonderful people. And it's about a quarter acre. At the time, there were some, you know, trees that were fallen and everything was unleveled. There was snow on the ground at the time. There was old refrigerators in the corner. And I'm just thinking, oh, man, I don't know if this is going to work. But I said, yes, let's do it. So spring 2009, we cleared the land and started building beds with cedar planks and rebar. We have about 20 50-foot beds. And as we're building, we're filling. I called all my friends up, ordered some pizza, got some beer, and that's kind of how it started. I did all my starts in the basement. I didn't really have a plan. I knew that, all right, sweet, I'll just sell to these restaurants that I've worked at all these years, like all my buds. Like, hey, yo, buy my produce, no big deal. I felt like, in a sense, starting an urban farm was smart because working in kitchens my whole life, knowing how, like, what chefs are looking for, knowing how to price it, how to package it. I feel like I kind of had a kind of upper hand in that sense. So I went with it. And the first thing I brought samples of to restaurants were micro radishes. I started thinning out my radishes going, oh, dude, these are beautiful. I can't throw these away. Clean them up a little. And they make beautiful garnish. So that's when I started looking at my produce from a chef's perspective. And it just took off from there. So we started with Beast, Ned Ludd, Grain and Gristle, Veritable Quandary. That was our start. And the first season was awesome. And over time, neighbors would walk by and be like, what's going on over here? Could I volunteer? Could I help out? And before the end of that season in 2009, we started a supper club. Basically, it was a brunch club. I would do brunch once a month. I would prep everything out of my little apartment in the Irvington, bring everything over to the farm where there is a kitchen there. And it would just be word of mouth, sliding scale, using eggs from the chickens and our produce, and just doing three courses, and whoever would come, awesome, whatever they wanted to pay, great. And that's what kind of kept my creative mind going. But at the same time, I was working 40 hours a week in a restaurant. I was at Lincoln at the time when I started the farm. And so I would do about 80 hours a week. And not much has changed since 6 years later.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of strands to the farm. And one of my questions was, how has it evolved over time? But it seems like you kind of have to pick each apart. And we don't necessarily need to do that, but I'm interested, how has the sort of supper club evolved since that original brunch club?
Okay. Well, like I said, the first year in 2009, it was more of a once a month doing a brunch. Then word started getting out, and I started getting emails like, hey, heard about your side yard farm brunch once a month. How could I get in on this? So that's when I talked to my landlords. It's like, hey, could I use this kitchen? We call it the barn. It's a really strange building. It's commercially zoned. It used to be an old bakery a long time ago. So our plans were one day to, like, let's turn this into a legal commercial kitchen. Sure. So that was on the radar. We're going to do that at some point. But for the time being, you know, everything was like under the radar. Like, sure. Okay, you know. So they let me basically transform this kitchen over time into, you know, commercial refrigeration, prep tables, you know, all the equipment I need, except I had an electric range, and that sucks. and just a regular oven, you know, household oven at the time. So, yeah, over time, then I started a newsletter. Hey, okay, I'll put a newsletter out there. I started a Facebook page, and I started reaching a larger audience. So then I started doing them weekly. And that's kind of what happened. I started collaborating with people in the neighborhood. I work with Cumbersome Multiples. They do all my letterpress menus. So if I have an idea, like, oh, I'm going to do this, like, crazy, I don't know, hops dinner or something, I need a menu. So her husband, Daniel Duford, great artist. He also does my ceramic plates and cob oven workshops. He'll just, you know, carve out something awesome, and she'll letterpress it, and then, you know, so that started being a thing. What else? Oh, yeah, just collaborating with people, like, in the industry. Like if they're like Be Local, for example, we did this awesome honey tasting brunch that went great. And working closely with like wine people and beer people, New Deal Distillery for their booze, basically anybody that would like contact me and be like, hey, you want to work together? I would never say no. Be like, yeah, you sound rad. Let's do this. So that's kind of how it evolved. And through their audience and my audience, it's just grown into this crazy thing 6 years later.
Yeah, it seems really, just hearing that, you kind of, it bounces around. It's sort of these whims, and you're just like, oh, that sounds like something fun to do.
Yeah.
I'll do that. And it just has sort of grown. That's sort of like the ideal way to grow something. Like,
yeah.
I want to do something that's fun, and then you do it, and it's successful, and people like it, and it allows you to do more fun things with people. And also, you get to work your network that you had been a part of for many years in the restaurant industry.
Definitely. I mean, my favorite thing I have to say is, you know, when I'll go deliver my produce, that's one thing that I can't let go of even 6 years later. You know, I finally gave Fridays to my farm manager, but every Tuesday I have to do it. I love seeing my people going into those kitchens. It's just that family feeling comes back. I really miss that. I haven't been in kitchens for the last 2 years since I've started the catering company and went full swing with this supper club. So getting to be in there and be like, what's up? And, you know, cursing a little bit and just getting to chat with the chefs, it makes me feel really good. But when I get to say, hey, man, I got this dinner next week, why don't you come? It's awesome to see chefs showing up to my suppers, you know, people that I truly respect and we have the same food philosophies. It's amazing. But I really think people are into the whole seed to plate. Like, whoa, this was grown on Urban Acres. It is on my plate. And I'm actually sitting here in this residential neighborhood eating this four-course meal. This is really awesome. So now we've taken it to the next level, which is nomadic suppers, I like to call it. Last year in spring, I did a Kickstarter that was successful for a 6x10 cargo trailer that I tricked out into a little kitchen. Actually, Mike Barnett from Red Trek Homestead was the mastermind behind building it out for me, like for my height, for everything I needed to execute in there and what I wanted to do. So we built this thing out, and what it is I get to take people, 24 people exactly, because that's what my tables seat. My buddy Jason built me these beautiful handcrafted wooden tables and benches. They seat 24 people. And once a month during the summer, June through October, I do these nomadic suppers. The last one was out at Gochee Farms in the middle of a hops field. And we had Commons Brewery out there pairing the beer. And basically the idea is to take people out to in the middle of nature to experience, for example, hops and beer. Wow, they go great together, obviously. Just to kind of give them the full circle.
If, you know, the catering business and the farm wasn't enough, you also have some educational programming that you do. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, for the last 3 years, we've been working with a group of girls. They call themselves Living City. There's four girls. They live in the Coley neighborhood, and they teach year-round garden education for adults and kids. They approached me a few years ago about starting a kids program at the farm. I was like, why not? Let's do it. That would be great. Sure. And it was a hit. And then they did it the next year. And now we're in our third season. We have like, I think there's 1 week left for this season. We plan on expanding that next year. We just got a new farm property about three blocks from the main property off Simpson 48th. It's 1 acre, and to me, that's huge because I've been farming on a quarter acre and a third of an acre. So now I'm just like, what am I going to do with all this land? So I'm going to dedicate a good portion of it to kids camp because right now they just have a couple garden beds, and more kids could be involved in the community now. And we're thinking about doing 1 to 2 weeks of bilingual Spanish-speaking kids camp. We thought that would be awesome. The community needs it. And offering scholarships as well.
I want to get into the conversation about urban farming and urban agriculture. And it seems like, you know, what I'm picking up is that you've really taken Side Yard Farm and diversified it, that you have a lot of different projects involved. And so I want to know your thoughts on urban farming and where it stands in sort of the larger food culture.
Well, I think 6 years ago when we started the cider farm that urban farming was brand spanking new. You know, it was just an idea. People were, you know, have been homesteading for forever. And actually making market gardens, making a business out of it was kind of a new thing. You know, 6 years later, now you're seeing more urban farms all throughout Portland. You know, southeast, northeast, the west side. I think it's awesome. I have to say, to be successful at it and, you know, to be able to quit your day job, that's tough. You have to have a niche. For sure. So yes, we are organic. We're not certified organic, but we are organic. And the chefs that I sell to, I only do restaurant sales. They know my food philosophies. They know that about me. So now we serve 15 restaurants around the Portland area, and they try to support as many urban farms as they can, not just mine, but the new up and coming. And I feel like, you know, since we've been around the last 6 years, the new urban farms around me that have started in the Coley, they've, you know, have reached out to me about, like, how could I do this? What should I do? Should I be a CSA? Should I do farmers markets, restaurants? I mean, help me. How could I figure this out to be successful? So, you know, we've done workshops in the past of how to start your own urban farm. And there's been two people that have taken that class and have actually started their own urban farm. One that's doing really great, you might know, in the St. John's area is Small Heart Farms. Hmm. Lacey. She's an amazing person. She still makes time to come volunteer at the side yard, which is crazy because she's so busy. But I think Portland is now noticing the effects of growing food on urban acres. And people want to know where their food comes from. When people walk by the farm, they do stop. They do say hello. They do ask questions. And I always give them a tour. And I think having, you know, farms in urban areas and having people see that, that they're living amongst these huge plots of land that are full of food, people just want more of that.
So. You do see the possibility when you're going around the city. Now when I see a vacant lot, it's like, well, that doesn't have to be vacant. Like, there could be something there. We could be growing food there.
Oh, yeah. It's funny. For the longest time, I would drive by that abandoned one-acre lot, the new one that we're starting now, all the time going, wow, that would be such a beautiful farm one day, you know, for like 8 years. Oh, yeah, that's going to be a beautiful... Oh, man, that would suck if something got built there. And then, you know, somebody bought it, heard about me. It was like, we didn't want housing development on this land. We want you to farm it. We will give you a killer deal. A killer deal. Can you farm it? And I was like, yeah, sure, why not?
Of course.
Let's do it. I can't say no. You guys are awesome. Let's just do this. So that's how that started. And I get emails all the time of, hey, I got this huge backyard and it's all grass. I want you to farm it. Can you? And I just pass those on to other farmers I know, or farmers I know that need that opportunity, that are coming out of the BUFA program, that want to get that first start in urban agriculture. But how do you do it? Do you get a business license? Is the health department involved? Department of Agriculture? There's so many questions that, like, new urban farmers have. And I was there too. So I just give it all away. I give all the secrets away. I don't care. At this point, it doesn't matter. I feel good with the relationships I have with the chefs I have and what I'm doing and my niche, that, you know, the more the merrier.
Sure. So I want to go big picture just for a moment.
Yeah.
And sort of ask you, like, what's the point? So, we're involved in this sort of urban farming movement. And it's like, what are we trying to accomplish?
That's a good question. Well, I think it's just what you're saying. Like, you drive by a vacant lot and you're like, that could be food, you know? So I think having more food accessible, especially in food deserts, you know, which are all over in every city across the United States, you know, to have these spaces and not just be a farm that sells to restaurants, but these other aspects, like a kids program, teaching children how to grow their own food. How to cook with that food, how to harvest it, how to make pickles, you know, really cool stuff like that, how to raise chickens, and what that all means. I think that is the greater picture of this whole thing. It's not just about restaurant sales and money. It's about getting your community involved. And I have to say, the community is involved in every part of the side yard farm. I can't get away from it. It's like I find myself in, you know, conversations, running into somebody at the grocery store every day. This is a daily thing, like, hey, and we just talk, and then there's a collaboration out of it, maybe. So it feels good to run into people and go, hey, my kid did kids camp last year, or I just ate at, you know, Old Salt and had your salad greens. That makes me feel so good.
Sure. I feel like it's literally, you know, urban farming is literally changing the landscape. And it also, like, those discussions and conversations wouldn't have been there had you not grown the greens that were eaten on that plate at Old Salt.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
And also, you know, we've been doing this now for, I want to say, 3 or 4 years. We do a DIY poultry slaughter workshop. We do one in the fall and one in the spring. And Daniel Brophy of Oregon Culinary Institute is the instructor for that. And I get emails all the time, when's the next one? When's the next one? We keep it small. It's usually 8 to 10 people. We provide a bird for everybody that comes, unless they want a BYOB, bring your own bird, you know, just to get that feeling of raising an animal and then bringing it with them and learning how to humanely slaughter the bird, fabricating the bird, and then they get to take it home. And we give them some cooking tips if they'd like, but you should see the people that show up. They first show up, like, pretty shaky, really nervous, hands in the pockets, you know. Eating, you know, I provide donuts and coffee, which just, you know, mix it up a little. And they start talking to each other. Then it's go time. And Daniel Brophy, man, he's just, like, to the point. Like, all right, who's first? And, you know, we...
All business.
All business. All time. Yeah, you know him?
Yeah, I know
him. Yeah, all business. Can't read the guy's face at all. It's funny. But so we'll set up a chair and, you know, put some hay on the ground for the blood. And we do it in the hoop house usually, just because we are in a residential neighborhood and there are a lot of kids. You know, a lot of kids seriously just open the farm gate and, you know, dart down the driveway. Like, what's going on? So for us, you know, that's important to us to, in a sense, kind of keep it covered. Sure. When we have these workshops. So, you know, showing people how to do that and letting them bleed out in a private place. So those have proven to be successful. And you know that everybody in Portland pretty much has their own chickens in the backyard or ducks. And there is a time where they are going to get older, or maybe there's a raccoon attack and they're hurt, or, you know, they need to be put down. But to be able to, like, show somebody, hey, this is how you could humanely do that, I think is rad.
I mean, so you're at this point been around for a little while. You're receiving acclaim, and I wanted to talk about the Local Hero Award that you recently received from EcoTrust. About that specifically, but also what it means to sort of get that acknowledgement. Folks want to pat you on the back for it. So how does that feel?
It was extremely emotional that evening at the EcoTrust. I did not go in there expecting to win. I was honored when I got nominated, especially for the restaurant chef category. We were nominated a couple of years ago for the farm category, and that was a surprise as well, because at that point we were only like 3 years in, and I think we were up against like Savvy Island Organics. I'm like, okay, awesome. Great, you know, to be nominated. But this time around, it, you know, I was like, wow, what a huge honor. I show up there, sitting there, they're calling names, you know, the category I was in with these amazing artisans. I mean, Higgins alone, I was like, cool, Higgins is going to win. Of course they are, because of who he is and what he's built over the years. So when they called the Side Yard Farm, I instantly got extremely emotional and went up there. And I believe the first words out of my mouth was not thank you. It was holy shit, because of how shocked. I was in shock, honestly. But to get that, to be honored for something like a Local Hero Award, it really opened my eyes. Like, wow, people, the audience we're reaching is much bigger than I thought. People are appreciating how much work we are doing. I mean, we're putting in a lot of work. You know, not only are we selling local produce in 15 restaurants around town, but we're also our seed-to-plate suppers and catering, even a 200-person wedding. Yeah, you bet I am, like, on my hands and knees searching for, like, fallen nasturtium pods to make capers, you know, using the goat milk up the street so I could make a huge batch of cheese. Like, everything, nothing goes to waste. It's, I run a farm like I run a kitchen, very resourceful. And, you know, even my basil, letting it die off, dry up, using that wood to smoke meat, I do not waste any part of the plant. So I think people are just noticing that, like, how extremely different and unique that is. And in a sense, it's really not. I mean, for years, people homestead, they do this. This is just how it is. It's kind of just bringing people back to that. And just to be noticed for something like that is a huge honor.
Stacey, this has been a real treat. Thank you so much for talking with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, man.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was Stacey Givens, owner and creator of The Side Yard Farm and Kitchen. To learn more about The Side Yard and to hear a story from Stacey about foraging with her mother as a child, head over to The Food Show page on the KBOO website. Next up, the Washington Gorge Action Program is a multi-purpose human service organization dedicated to helping individuals, families, and communities address basic human needs. Part of their programming is nutrition assistance and food banks that help to address the food needs of the community. Unfortunately, there have been cuts to the organization that make it difficult to fulfill their mission. On the phone, we have Pat Sajak, the department director for the Washington Gorge Action Programs, or WGAP food program, to talk with us about her organization and what they are doing to overcome the budget shortfall. Pat, welcome to The Food Show.
Hi, thank you very much for having me on.
Yes. First off, tell us a bit about the nutrition assistance and food bank programs at Washington Gorge Action Programs.
Well, first off, Washington Gorge Action Programs is the main lead agency and distribution center for both Klickitat and Skamania counties. We serve all food that comes to us to be given out through Northwest Harvest, Second Harvest, any farmers that donate, what have you, all come into Washington Gorge Action Programs first. And then we break it all down and get it out to our food banks. We have one food bank in Stevenson. We have one in Goldendale. We have one in Klickitat. We have a small pantry up here in White Salmon, plus our own food bank here in Washington Gorge Action. And so out of that, this past year, we have seen about a 11% decrease in our funding. Our funding usually comes from federal, state, and local funds. And with still the great need that is out there for folks, we have had to take some drastic cuts. We have been down to 36 hours for all of us for about the last 2 years, and this last year we were really about $25,000 short in our food program to keep it going. So we had to come down with some strong things to do, and one of them was that we normally would deliver and pick up all of our food from Northwest Harvest and Second Harvest and then deliver them out to our food banks, who they in turn are mostly volunteer food banks or partially funded food banks, and having them now come up with volunteers to come in and pick the food up from us. And that was just heart-wrenching for us to have to do that to them, because we're not only hurting, but so are they. And so along with that then comes the need to go out and look for extra funding, and that is what we're going to try to do this Saturday with the fundraiser that we're going to be doing at the Interpretive Center in Stevenson.
Right. KBOO is helping to sponsor a fundraiser this weekend. So tell us more about the event.
Well, I'd like to just kind of give the folks just before that just a little idea of what's happening in Klickitat and Skamania County. We're running about one family in 12 that's running out of food as a result. They're eating less. They're going without food. They're on using not very nutritious food for them. And then Klickitat County, it's one in seven. We gave out 697,000 pounds of food last year, 12,635 boxes of food, and this year we're already halfway to that point as of end of June. So our need is out there very strongly, and so this fundraiser that is coming up right now is one that I hope as many can attend as possible. It's going to be a lot of fun. We have a style show that is being put on by A Boutique, and 20% of all of their sales, it's back to school fashions, and 20% of all of their sales will go to our food banks. The Stevenson High School pep band will be playing. We'll have Andreas Ehrlich playing for us. He is a guitarist. And then we'll do our silent auction and fundraising there. And some of the things that are coming on our silent auction, which might spear a few more people to come, is that we've got, like for one, we've got the golf cart for two at the Skamania Lodge to go golfing. We have an 8-person wine tour. We have a night stay at the Skamania Lodge and many other things that are on board, but those are a few highlights for everyone. And just going to have a good time and hope that everybody can come.
Sounds like a great event.
Yeah.
So why has the funding decreased so much for the program?
Well, our state funding, all across, and I'm sure all organizations are feeling it right now, that their grants are being cut. Ours are too. And not only that, it's the economy right now. Our donations are down. It's not only cash, but food donations and the rest. And it just sort of hits everybody all the way around. And there was a time that it only took one person to be able to work and feed their family. Well, now it's taking both husband and wife and doing 2 and 3 jobs to try to make ends meet. And things are looking still going to be on the tough side for a while yet for everyone. And so one thing leads to another, and soon it becomes just a tumbling act all the way down the line. And so with us, we had to, like I say, we had to sell our trucks. We still have one truck for sale, by the way, if anybody out there is interested. But and then cutting hours and trying to still be able to give to the folks that are in need. And that is our whole purpose, is to be here to help those that need some short-term relief or longer term with all our other different programs that we have. And that's our job, to be there to help someone else.
How can our listeners help out or get involved with the Washington Gorge Action Programs?
Well, first of all, it would be great if you could come to the event, but I know everybody can't. The next thing they could do is we have a website. It's wgap.ws, and they can go online there and check out our other programs. They can also donate online, and they can also volunteer online. And I know everybody that's listening is not close to our food banks here in Klickitat and Skamania County, but the need is out there, and I would hope that they would take that time to go to their nearest food bank and donate their time. Volunteer hours are very important to all the food banks. If we didn't have volunteers, the food banks could not exist. So it's not only our food banks, but it's food banks all across Oregon, Washington, and the like. And not only doing that, another thought is that people are doing their gardens right now. If they have a little bounty left, it would be great to take to your closest food bank or meals program that is there. And then maybe next year think about, okay, I could maybe plant a row or two that I can just totally dedicate to a food bank or a meal program. But we all can get involved and all be able to help somewhere along the line. And so those are ways. And like with our organization, it's not just food. We have a weatherization program. We have others where anybody that would be able to make a difference would be to volunteer to help. Maybe they have building skills, or maybe they have time that they could go spend at a youth center to help somebody out, or domestic violence, sexual assault. I mean, there's so many areas that people out there across the states could really make a difference in all of these organizations by volunteering.
Great, right. Well, thank you, Pat, for coming on the show. Again, that
You're
was
welcome.
Yes, thanks. That was Pat Sajak, Department Director of Washington Gorge Action Program's Food Program. You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO. Now we're going to go a different route with an old French tale from professional storyteller Brian Rohr. This story is especially relevant as we enter apple season in the Pacific Northwest. If you're able to, I recommend closing your eyes and turning off the lights for the next 9 minutes. Here's the story from Brian Rohr.
Sorry, Rachel, a little bit of technical problem here. I'm going to try and solve it.
In my belly, need some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same.
So stories like this one are basically stories that you just imagine yourself at a pub, at some ancient pub. All right, with a glass of mead or some old cider that's been brewing for a really long time, with the storyteller sitting on top of the bar, everyone gathered around with their pints. That's this kind of a story that we're going to hear. So it was a long, 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 long time ago, back in some ancient land, back in some ancient place, in some ancient time, there was a tree. Not just any tree. This was an apple tree. An old, gnarly, beautiful apple tree. Some say, in fact, it may be the first apple tree that ever came into existence. But regardless of that, what we know is that this tree, this beautiful apple tree, had the most delicious apples in all the land. The best, most delicious apples. And there was an old woman who was the steward of this tree. And she loved this tree. She loved this tree more than anything else. But here's the thing. The thing that pissed her off, the thing that got her goat more than anything else, was the fact that people would come all the time and steal the apples off the tree. If they would only ask, it would be fine. She would give them some apples, no problem, but they never came and asked. They always just came and stole from the tree. Oh, and it made her so angry. One day, there was a knock on her door. And she went and she opened the door. And there was this person there, this stranger she'd never seen before. And the person said, "Hello, I am a wanderer. I'm a traveler. And I noticed this apple tree out front. I wonder if I might have an apple to take with me on my journey." And the old woman, oh my gosh, someone finally asked her for an apple. Someone asked, they requested it. And she was so excited. She went out there herself. She picked so many apples, put them in a bag for him, gave it to him. And he was about to leave and he said, "You know, for your generosity, I'm going to grant you a single wish. Anything you want, it'll be yours." Whoa, this delighted the old woman, and she thought about it, and she thought about it. First, she was like, "Whoa, maybe I can have gold. But what good is gold? What do I need gold for? What else? What else? What else?" And then she got it. She said, "What I wish for is that anyone who takes an apple from my tree is stuck to the tree until I let them go." And the traveler said, "So it is." And she turned and looked at the tree to see if anything changed. The tree still looked like it always did. She turned back to the traveler, but the traveler was gone. Well, by and by, she was inside her place, having a little bit of breakfast, when all of a sudden, from outside, she heard some screaming, the screaming of some kids, "Let me down, let me down, let me down." And she went outside, she saw there were three kids just hanging in the tree. She said, "Let me down, let me down, let us out, we're stuck here, we can't get down, let us down." And the old woman just cackled and laughed and laughed and said, "No, I'm not letting you down anytime soon." And she went back inside. Well, some time later, she heard some other voices
from out front, and she went outside, and there in the tree was the banker, was the schoolmaster, was the was a priest and a rabbi and imam, and all these people were just hanging off this tree, just hanging there. He said, "Let us down, let us down." And she said, "No, I'm not letting you down. I'm not letting you down." And by the end of the day, there were so many people hanging off this tree. She went outside. She said, "Listen, I will let you down only and only if you promise that you'll never steal apples from this tree again." "Okay, okay, we promise, we promise we won't steal a tree. Just let us down, let us down." So she let everyone down and they went on her way, and she went inside feeling very pleased with herself. Well, some time passed, and one day there was a knock at her door. And she opened the door, and there was a stranger there, though the stranger was very familiar to her. She could tell by the look in the stranger's eyes. They were dark, they were deep. You looked in, and you saw universes and universes, but even more, you saw into the deep void. And she knew that this was the spirit of death himself. And she said to him, "Well, what do you want?" And he said, "I've come to take you on a long journey that everyone must walk." And she said, "Well, if I must go, I must, but I'm sure the journey is long and I will get hungry. Do you mind if I take a snack with me?" And he said, "Oh, no problem, just hurry up." And she said, "Well, how about this? I'll take care of putting the cheese together inside here. Why don't you go out to the apple tree and pick a few apples? And that way we'll have some food for our journey." And so she went inside, and Death went to the apple tree. And sure enough, Death got stuck to the apple tree. "Let me down! Let me down!" Death screamed. "Let me down!" And she went out there and she looked at Death and she said, "No way. I am not letting you down." And days went by, weeks went by, months went by, years went by, and she still didn't let Death free. And all over the world, people weren't dying. You know, people all of a sudden might get run over by a carriage, but they didn't die. People may get sick, but they didn't die. People may get old, but they didn't die. The balance of the world was off. At first, everyone was happy, but, you know, over time, people started to realize maybe having death in this world isn't such a bad thing. One day, after 10 years went by. Death said, "Please, you must let me down. The balance is so off in the world. The balance is so off." And she said to him, "I will let you down if you promise me, if you promise me that you will not come for me until I choose." He said, "That is impossible. No one can determine the time of their own death." And she said, "Then I will not let you down." He said, "Fine, fine. I make that promise." And so she let Death down, and order was restored in the world once again. And they say that maybe it was that this old woman lived out a good long life, and finally one day, she was ready to die. Others say that she is still alive to this day. And there are those out there who say that her name was Misere. And maybe that is why there is still some Misere in this world. At least that's what they say. That's how it happened. And that is all I know. Thank you so much.
You're listening to The Food Show on KBOO Community Radio. That was professional storyteller Brian Rohr For a link to an interview with Brian, visit the Food Show page on the KBOO website. Also, if you are interested in seeing Brian perform, he has a show tomorrow evening, 7 p.m. at Awakenings Wellness Center, entitled Water, Floods, and the Sacred Wound. Now we're going to go to speak with Heather Langhorst Cal, Finance Director for Yes on 92, the Oregon Right to Know campaign. Welcome to the show, Heather.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah. Heather, tell us about the campaign and Measure 92.
So Measure 92 is a nonpartisan grassroots campaign to label genetically engineered food in grocery stores. It's on the ballot this November 4th, and so we're really excited to turn people out to vote. We've been working really hard with our field efforts across Oregon and engaging many different coalitions to participate in the campaign.
Can you tell us some of the details about the measure?
Well, that's the nice thing about the measure is it's a very explicit, very easy-to-read measure, and it simply is to label any ingredients that already have a label that contain genetically engineered ingredients.
So why should we be labeling genetically modified foods?
So we believe that everybody has the right to know what's in the food they're eating and feeding their families. Regardless of like environmental concerns or health concerns or religious concerns, we believe that everyone has the right to know what's in the food they're eating. So that's why it's just basic consumer rights.
Can you tell us a little bit about the most common genetically modified organisms that are produced in the United States?
Yeah, of course. So corn, about 90% of corn produced in the United States is genetically engineered, as well as papaya out of Hawaii and soy.
Okay. And are they found, would you say that they're found in a large percentage of products in the stores?
Yeah, of course. So corn is basically found in everything, whether it be corn syrup or cornmeal, or, you know, anything made with corn, because, as I said, 90% of corn produced in the U.S. is GMO.
What about as far as produce?
So it's the same for produce. Anytime you purchase corn in the store, it's likely genetically engineered. Otherwise, it's probably labeled or it's organic. Mm-hmm. Same thing goes for papaya or any kind of soy that you purchase.
Okay, and so you all are hosting an event this Friday.
Yes, we are. It's called Dish 92.
Tell us about the event.
So I mentioned earlier that we have many coalitions who have come out to support the campaign, and one of those very special coalitions is our Chef and Restaurant Coalition. So this Friday, August 22nd, 14 restaurants and chefs are going to be coming together to make handcrafted appetizers and hors d'oeuvres for our guests. And it's a really special event because New Seasons Market has provided all of the meat, which is also GMO-free. An organically grown company and Cuckoo Lawn Farms have provided all of the produce, also GMO-free. So we're really excited to share Oregon's Bounty with the many guests who are joining us on Friday.
So where is this event going to be held?
It's at the Castaway. Sorry, I have a truck driving by. It's at the Castaway at that's 1900 Northwest 18th Avenue. It's in Northwest Portland. And it starts at 6 p.m., goes until 9 p.m. David Bronner from Dr. Bronner's Magic Soap is going to be joining us as a special guest, along with James Beard Award-winning chef Greg Higgins from Higgins Restaurant. Tickets are $100 a piece and can be found at dish92.com.
Okay. So do they need to be purchased ahead of time, or can somebody just show up and attend the event?
Either way is fine. You can show up at the door and purchase tickets at the door is fine.
Okay, so what kind of support have you had in your campaign so far?
Support as in what way?
Have you had a lot of positive reactions from people, and have you had organizations that are supporting you?
Yeah, we have brought a broad coalition of organizations supporting us, from local farmers to chefs and restaurants, as I mentioned, to business owners and business leaders in our community. And so we have, I think as of our last update, we had about 2,500 Oregonians have supported the campaign with a contribution, and a small contribution at that. So when I said this is a grassroots campaign, I really meant that. The only way we're going to win against Monsanto and other big chemical companies is to have voter-to-voter contact. And so we've been talking to a lot of voters all over the state since May, and the outpouring of support has been phenomenal.
What kind of opposition have you run into?
You know, the opposition hasn't been much. You have to remember that the opposition's campaign is going to be funded by five big chemical companies. They don't have people on the ground. So for the most part, people really do want to know what's in their food. And it's not because they, you know, think that GMOs are bad, but they want to have a choice.
So there have been some other states that are on the verge of labeling GMOs. Can you tell us anything about what's going on around the states?
Yeah, so Vermont won, I think, in May. Through a legislative action, which has been a significant amount of momentum for us here in Oregon. And then also, obviously, everyone knows, hopefully, about Jackson County here in Oregon, who banned GMO seeds, which has also really jump-started our campaign.
Great. Well, that's all the time we have for this episode of The Food Show. Thank you, Heather, so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
And again, the event is Friday evening. And come support if you want to support the Oregon Right to Know campaign. And
Dish92.com.
What's that again?
I said it's Dish92.com.
Dish92.com. All right. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a good day.
All right. I want to thank our guests, Stacey Givens, Pat Sajak, Brian Rohr, and Heather Langhorst-Cal. I'd also like to thank our amazing board operator, Tammy. For more information about what you heard on today's episode, visit the Food Show page on the KABU website. A reminder, the Food Show airs every third Wednesday of the month. Don't change the dial. Next up on KABU is Jazz Lives. Until next month, I'm Rachel Bennett. Thanks for listening.
Some drink for the dry in my throat. Need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. Don't you know it ain't right for people to go hungry with all the food being thrown away? Just because it ain't the right size or perfect, 'cause you can't turn a fast dollar that way. You know it ain't right to make people grow coffee when their families could be growing food, working those lands for corporations. Don't do hungry people no good, 'cause people need food in their belly. Need some drink for the dry in their throat, need for the world to recognize it. Everybody's in the same holy boat. People got to have food in their belly. Need some drink. Just to grow a bunch of cheap hamburger meat. You know those trees, they hold the tops off, and those burgers aren't fit to eat. And you know it ain't right to punish the farmers for growing food clean and poison free. There ought to be a government who protect them, put tax dollars where they need to be. 'Cause people need food in their belly. They need some drink for the dry. Belly.
everybody's in the same old boat.
And that's it for public affairs programming for this morning. And we thank you very much for tuning in today. This is KBOO Portland, and this KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, From Our Hands to Yours, celebrating 41 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March 1st through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. Also by Northwest Connector, connecting riders to the Oregon coast through daily round-trip bus routes from Portland, Salem, and Corvallis. Northwest Connector buses are equipped with bike racks and offer 3-day and 7-day passes with transfers up and down the coast. Schedules and trip planner at nwconnector.net. And coming up in just a little bit will be the KBOO Noon News Headlines, and then Jazz Lives with Nick at, when that's over. Okay. Thank you very much for tuning in today. Stay tuned.
Sanity. Panicum. To the spank world of Bam. Ser.
This is KBOO Headline News at Noon for August 20th, 2014. I'm Diane Erickson.
And I'm Patrick Wilson.
In local news, the Oregon Business Association is awarding its Statesman of the Year Award to Penny and Phil Knight for their cancer fundraising. The couple is effectively raising $1 billion for cancer research by pledging $500 million and encouraging individual donors to give $500 million in matching funds.
The 8th annual cleanup of Johnson Creek is planned for Saturday, August 23rd, from 9 a.m. to noon. Last year, volunteers removed 3.5 tons of trash upstream and downstream of Mill Park Creek in Milwaukee.
Evacuation orders were given to some 13,000 households and businesses in Central California Monday when a wildfire approached a foothill community near Yosemite National Park. The blaze consumed nearly 1,200 acres, causing the evacuation of 4 hotels in Oakhurst, about 14 miles from the park.
According to a Commerce Department announcement Tuesday, housing starts rebounded vigorously in July after 2 straight months of declines. A limited supply of properties for sale has also lifted prices, pushing housing out of the reach of many first-time buyers. The housing market's recent weakness appears to be reversing, while the labor market appears to be improving. A moderate increase in consumer prices seems to indicate that the Federal Reserve will still keep interest rates low for now.
The powerful U.S. Chamber of Commerce is providing funding to the Republican Party preferred candidate, who has been struggling to raise funds in a three-way Republican race in Arizona. This race represents one of the most competitive House races in the country.
The company that supplies the Israeli army with tear gas is the same company supplying the police in Ferguson, Missouri. Since the 19-